So you can see the title of the talk. Actually, it's neutrino focused, but a lot of it will be electron scattering also. And they're interwoven, as you'll see through this talk. I really had some debate with myself on what to present here to you. And I kind of changed my mind about a week and a half ago. It's obvious most of the focus most of you have is, and rightly so, on low energy nuclear physics. And what I'm talking about is high energy nuclear physics. You're going to see that there are all sorts of things that we're fighting that are very different problems from the ones that you folks are by and large fighting. Our modeling at some level is more primitive than yours, but we have to deal with high energies, and that's a major difficulty of what we're doing. So I decided what I'd do is patch together what's more of a colloquium than it is a seminar for most of it. It's more pedagogical. It doesn't spread out all the nitty-gritty details of what we've done. There are lots of them, and I could give that kind of talk, but I just felt it wouldn't be really the most productive. So you have to view this as, you know, almost a colloquium-type talk rather than...
Where's the photo from?
My wife and I are both backpackers. We go to the Sierra every August and take hundreds and hundreds of pictures every year for the last 40 years. So this one is Lower Morgan Lake. So this mountain is, I don't know what it is, 13,500, something like that. So they're heavy duty. There was nobody else at the lake when we were there. Okay, here's the outline. I want to make some introductory comments. And these are very, you know, sort of generic, but I think to set the stage. I will talk about relativistic effects, and what I chose to do is actually use a very simple toy model. And to me, it's a toy model. It turns out that most of the analyses of neutrino reactions, especially at Fermilab energies, is done using this toy model, which is disgraceful. Basically, it's not a very good model. But it captures a lot of what is the problem, and so I thought that I'd present that to you. It's amazing. I don't find this in most textbooks or review articles. It's something you may not be aware of. I'm going to spend a fair amount of time on scaling. We've done a lot on scaling for probably 2 to 3 decades. Again, some of the ideas may be familiar, many of them probably not. I'll talk about the effects from two-body operators, but handled at the relativistic level as we do, where it will seem incredibly naive, the modeling we do, but as I'll point out when we get there, it's not so simple. Then I'll bring you up to date on the most modern representation, I would say, of inclusive electron scattering. The motivation here is you must understand electron scattering before you can go on and do anything sensible with neutrinos. The nuclear physics and the semi-leptonic physics is so similar in the two cases that if you fail with electron scattering, you just have no right to pretend for neutrinos. So then I'll talk about inclusive charge-changing neutrino reactions, as these are the core pieces of the programs at Fermilab and in Japan. And these are big, big programs. So another message I'd like to get over here is that, take Fermilab as an example, this is their future, their high-intensity frontier, as they like to call it. So this multi-billion dollar facility does this kind of physics. And there's no way around it. This physics is nuclear physics, unfortunately. For reasons that we could come back to at the end, the unfortunate part is it's being done by people who don't know very much nuclear physics. And they do incredibly naive things with the modeling and the analysis and the event generators and all the things that must be done for these big experiments. And this is a major problem. There are things they're doing that I think are really not correct. It's a big deal because this is how we're learning about the properties of neutrinos, neutrino oscillations. And as I'll say it, and then maybe at the end say it again, but it's obvious, everybody here knows it. The oscillation formulas always involve this ratio, L over E. Well, you know what the length is if you go from where you produce the neutrino to where you detect it. The problem is they don't know the energy. Despite the fact they show plots of the x-axis has the neutrino energy, that is not really the neutrino energy. That is a derived quantity that involves a model. And so it's a problem. Now, what they're doing, and this is maybe the last I'll say about the experimental directions that are being followed, what they're doing is they're taking, again, a very particle physics point of view. Namely, if you can detect more things, it's better. And if you think, you know, LHC or any program over many decades, it's always been a movement to measure more and more and more things, and therefore define the events that you're seeing better and better. Unfortunately, in this case, because nuclear physics does play a major role, the more semi-inclusive or exclusive, if you like, you make the event that you've detected, the worse it is for us trying to do the modeling. Because the modeling gets shakier and shakier and shakier as you go more and more semi-inclusive. And so I'm going to spend a little bit of time, not very much, but at least expose you to what semi-inclusive, semi-electronic weak, electroweak processes look like in terms of the number of response functions and the general character of this. And I'll say a few words about deuterium. I think I'll use the blackboard to try and make a point there. And then if I get time, I'll come to this neutral current business where we relate moderate energy neutrino scattering, coherent scattering in this case, to parity-violating electron scattering. There's some beautiful relationships that I would like to expose to you. And then I'll summarize things. Okay, so let me start with some basic statements. I'm going to spend most of the time, as I said, on inclusive scattering. So just to define what that means, only the final state lepton is detected. And in the case of an electron, you have a beautifully defined beam, typically. Let's take Jefferson Lab as an example. And you detect the scattered electron very, very well in a spectrometer. So you know incident energy, final energy, scattering angle. Therefore, you know momentum transfer, energy transfer very, very well. Unfortunately, when you do this with neutrinos, you have a very poorly defined neutrino beam. Typically, these things peak at 800 MeV to a GeV for a low-energy beam at Fermilab with a broad distribution. You just can't get around it. And so everything is convoluted with your knowledge of the incident beam. You detect the muon, in this particular example, pretty well. And so you know the muon's energy or momentum and angle, but you don't know the initial condition. And so every different event, which came from, with some probability, a different neutrino energy, has different kinematics. So the momentum transfer keeps moving with every event. It's not as pristine as electron scattering. And this is a major problem in trying to understand things. Semi-inclusive means detecting other particles. And in fact, for this purpose, it's going to mean protons, because the movement that's going on at Fermilab is to use argon as the target and detect not only the muon, but also protons in argon. They make a time projection chamber of argon. So this is semi-inclusive is the direction they're going. And I'll say more when we get to that. So one has quasi-elastic scattering. This is, of course, familiar to everyone. It's basically knocking a nucleon out of a nucleus. It's not that simple, but that's the dominant thing that's happening. And it's peaking at roughly this value, the four momentum transfer over the nucleon mass. Not exactly, of course, and not symmetrically around that point, but it's obvious that this is the dominant process. So what the experimentalists do when they are studying electrons is they have inclusive scattering that has a peak in this region, but then it has more stuff at higher excitation energy. where you start producing pions, the delta comes into play, eventually deep and elastic scattering. In the case of neutrinos, what they do is they select events where they do not see a pion. So it's sort of a no pion inclusive cross section. And this is hard to get one's mind around at some level, because they call it quasi-elastic, but it really means no pion. And there's a problem there, because you can produce a pion and have it absorbed and leave no signal. And so there are events that are being miscounted, which they have to correct for using a model. So
they also could miss the pions also, right?
Yeah, but not very many. These are big volume detectors. I mean, these are things that in one case are big tanks of water, in another case hydrocarbon, but they're hundreds to thousand ton type things, detector slash target. So you pretty much see it. And they're these Cherenkov rings, and they look one way if they're a muon, a different way if they're an electron, and still a different way if they're a pion. And so they say, I saw a pion, and they throw those events into a different box. It's pretty good. I don't think that's the major problem. I think the major problem is some of the pions just don't leave a signal. They just, there's no Cherenkov ring, and so they call them quasi-elastic. But there are other things. It's not as simple as just knock out a single nucleon. For instance, two-body NEC, you can have two particle two holes, so you can knock out two nucleons. But of course, the whole many-body problem comes into play with initial and final state interactions. So this, there can be multi-particles emitted very easily. And this is one of the issues of trying to understand and model this at some level. Also inelastic, as I've said, where pions are detected. So I've just summarized the major goals. The three-star goal, obviously, is to study neutrinos. That's the main thing one is after. But auxiliary goals are, one hopes to get more knowledge at modest to fairly high values of the momentum transfer of the, let's say, the axial form factor. Because this is a tough thing to get at, typically. I could say more about what has been done to measure the axial form factor at high Q squared, but it's let's push on. And then we, at least, are interested in the nuclear physics aspects of the problem. How well can we do high-energy nuclear physics? Okay. I've said this already. You really have to do electron scattering in concert with neutrinos. Okay, so let me give you this little toy model. So what is the paradigm for a lot of this? And it's used, as I say, practically in most of the analyses. So if you've heard talks on neutrinos by the Fermilab people, let's say, Minnie Boone and many of the other experiments, the basic analysis has been done using the relativistic Fermi gas, which is kind of shaky if you think about it. Its great merit, however, is that it builds in some of the symmetries we needed. It truly is relativistic, covariant. All the nucleons are on shell. There's never a problem with that. And one has gauge invariance at the level you have this naive model. So it's got a lot going for it at these kind of energy scales, this kind of energy scale. So what's the kind of answer? Well, let me talk about relativity. Okay, there are at least three reasons that one should worry about this. And they're not distinct, they're all wrapped up together. But it's useful to try and pull it apart a little bit. There are obviously just kinematic effects. The kinetic energy operator is non-relativistically is not the same as relativistically. But additionally, there are boost effects in the single particle matrix elements that enter into the problem, and the two particle matrix elements for that matter. So that if you are hitting the nucleons and the nucleus hard enough, they are recoiling significantly, and that has an effect. There are Lorentz contractions, time dilations. The currents are not for a proton or neutron sitting at rest. And you think, okay, well, maybe even at a GeV or so, that's not very important, but stay tuned and you'll see. And then there really are the tough parts of it, the truly dynamical effects in the wave functions themselves. So the four-component spinners for nucleons have lower components, and those are not trivially related to the upper components. So let me take these apart very quickly without a lot of explanation, but just to give you the flavor of things that we've looked at. Many years ago, in fact, we devised a sort of procedure which seems to work pretty well. It's basically to take the energy transfer omega here and replace it, as you can see, by a corrected omega. Now, this is designed to take you from three momentum transfer to four momentum transfer. So if your non-relativistic model says that the quasi-elastic peak should be at 3q squared over 2m, this now adjusts it effectively to be 4q squared. You can make better arguments. This is a little hand-waving just to give you the flavor. You can make better arguments with some modeling that this is not a crazy thing to do. You'd like to do better, of course, and really have a relativistic Hamiltonian or Lagrangian. Yeah?
What's the difference between big Q and small Q?
Big, for me, is four momentum transfer. Small is three. Yeah. Barry's probably laughing because we had to remove all those things from our book. Years ago, I decided what I would do is make four vectors capital letters and three vectors lowercase. And so q squared is actually minus q squared. Boost effects. Well, you know, one can just go and look at single particle matrix elements and then say, how do they change if your nucleon is moving as against being at rest? You usually see these things written out for particles at rest, but there's nothing that prevents you from having them moving. And what you find is you get these factors of gamma, 1 over gamma, where this is basically the ratio of 3 to 4 momentum transfer, this being larger than 1, that particular ratio, since we're space-like. So for instance, you find that the charge response, quasi-elastic charge response, is enhanced by a factor of that sort, which is amounting to the fact that there are Lorentz contractions. The density is a little higher because of this recoil that's going on. Whereas, interestingly, the transverse response actually gets diminished by the same factor. Now, a lot of these things were recognized as far back as the 1960s. So, for instance, this factor that goes in the longitudinal has always been included from the late 1960s in the so-called Coulomb sum rule. Everybody who's analyzed it always has understood you should have that factor included. Unfortunately, a great deal of modeling being done today doesn't include these boost factors at all. And then there are dynamical effects. Here we have to resort to some kind of model, and we've typically done mean field, relativistic mean field type modeling, and tried to get a sense of what happens when you really have some dynamics with lower components being non-trivially related to the upper components. And I'll show you results as we pass along here. Okay, so here's a typical example. This is a momentum transfer of 1 GV over C, which is very typical for this problem. That's the sort of aim point for Fermilab for neutrinos. This is actually electron scattering. It doesn't really matter. The transverse response, the relativistic Fermi gas. So that's very characteristic of the sort of thing we're dealing with. Momentum transfer, three momentum transfer is a GV over C. The energy transfer, where this is peaking, is you know, sort of 400 or 500 MeV. And so many of the talks that I've been hearing over the last 3 weeks are not modeling that's applicable here. These are really very high energies comparative to where a lot of the approximations are to go. Okay, so we can, in this model, this is why I'm presenting it, this toy model, we can also do the non-relativistic Fermi gas. So were you to do a non-relativistic model and believe the Fermi gas captures at least some of this, you can now just compare the two. So the typical thing you will find in most discussions is relativistic effects are few percent effects. And they're characterized by a binding energy, let's say, in the ground state of whatever nucleus you're interested in, compared to the mass of the nucleon. And so it's sort of tens of MeV compared to a GeV. We're talking about few percent relativistic effects. The problem here is that the final nucleon is at 500 MeV. And so this is not trivial. Okay, so what does the non-relativistic look like? The reason I've left so much space out here will be obvious, because this is what the non-relativistic looks like. And you can see this is really the core of the problem. If you don't deal with the relativistic aspect of this problem, you're dead in the water, basically. There's just no way that one is going to do anything sensible without taking into account modeling of this sort, however sophisticated. This can be ab initio modeling of carbon 12, and you would be dead in the water because of this. Yeah.
When you say Fermi gas, do you mean you set a temperature? Is there some temperature that you're setting?
No, this is the zero temperature Fermi gas. It's basically, there is a relativistic way to build it, which we actually did some years ago. You start off with plane waves, and you have them colliding with each other. You can even do it in Cartesian coordinates if you want, and having their helicities opposed. So net momentum is zero, net spin is zero, go to the next state. Net momentum is zero, next spin is zero, and fill it up to the Fermi level and empty above. And so that actually gives you a covariant picture with spinners for each of these nucleons.
So, but is there some box you're putting it in some sort
of which is in effect periodic boundary conditions if you want, yeah.
So I'm trying to understand. So the initial state is just a ground state Fermi gas.
Right, and the final state is a one particle, one hole in that Fermi gas.
So I'm trying to understand how all the relativity is coming in. Is the relativity really in the initial state? Because how tightly are you confining
the... It's wherever it needs to be, because we just put spinners up to the Fermi level, make a particle hole state up to 500 MeV particle and hole with the spinners. And it's because of that 500 MeV that the relativity really starts coming in. It's not the initial state.
It's not the initial state.
That's negligible.
But Fermi gas is just a dispersion relation that is different also from relativistic, because you can also put out one boundary condition.
Exactly. Right. There are many different ways of coming to it. Okay. And in fact, what we did some years ago, this is kind of getting off the track, but because we wanted to relate what it predicts for the spectral function, which I'll come to a little bit later, for more realistic modeling, we actually tried to build the model to get a spectral function and therefore to get the standard Fermi gas answer. Usually it's just pulled out of the air, basically. But that's essentially what it is. And you know, you think about it, this is appalling to have built something with plane waves going through each other and make this the ground state and particle hole. This is crazy.
But the assumption somehow is that there's some confining force that makes all the excitations confined to this cavity.
This is the sort of mystery of it. There's one parameter, which is the Fermi momentum. You make the degenerate approximation. Now, I should say this is built on the electron gas for condensed matter physics. So it's exactly what you do. I mean, it's chapter two in Federal Moleculae, if you want. This is exactly how you start the problem.
But in the case of the electrons, it's obvious that they're confined to the actual material.
Yeah.
It's not so obvious that there's a wall there that prevents the excited particle states from leaving.
That's right. So I'm not disagreeing. I'm not trying to defend the Fermi gas. I'm just saying this is what we have, basically.
Okay,
and getting anything to as a test bed is very hard to have enough relativistic content. That's the problem. We would like to do better with some more interacting, you know, confined relativistic mean field theory. And we've done some of that. But for pedagogical reasons, I've stuck to this. Because as I said on the previous slide or so, we have these two kind of fixes, which in quotes we call relativizing, okay? And so what you can try is to make those two fixes. Fix the kinematics, put the boost factors in, okay? And use this as your starting point and see what happens. And what happens is, this is just saying what I said, is this. So if I shift the energy transfer with that little formula I gave you, you move the peak from here to here. It comes over much closer to the relativistic answer. And then the boost factor in this case moves you from here to here. So the boost factor is not trivial. The boost factor is sort of a 20% effect for 1 GV over C. It's much larger as you go to larger values. Now, what one finds is the relativistic Fermi gas actually puts the peak in about the right position experimentally. It's not exactly right, but it tracks up to very, very high momentum transfers. It is so bad, I mean, this model is so crazy, that you can actually apply it to deuterium, would you believe it? You can actually take the two-body problem, do deuterium, break it up, and go to very high momentum transfers, and the peak just beautifully tracks what the Fermi gas says it should. It's amazing. It's crazy.
It's a bit surprising that the threshold is so well shifted on the left-hand side. I mean, this is only about 300 MeV energy transfer, yeah. Right? So one wouldn't expect such a big effect.
It's true, and basically you have to go in and look at 3q squared over 4q squared, which now involves omega, and compare the different variables to see how big is the effect.
The Fermi momentum is identical in all these curves.
Exactly, yeah. So long ago it was realized that this spreading, and this just keeps going out further and further, is absolutely not seen experimentally. That is just completely in conflict with experiment. And however bad you think this crazy model, it's not so bad. It actually, it's sort of at the, 30% level in agreement with experiment. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
How did you actually fix the parameters? So did you put in some typical nuclear density?
In this case, I just chose a typical Fermi momentum. In fact, I chose the one that was used for carbon. There's only one parameter. Everything else is fixed.
And as an alpha barrier, if you consider different nuclei, or?
Oh, we've looked at many different nuclei, yeah. I mean, this is, again, this was pedagogy. This was just one case to show you what happens if you do this. No, of course, the model is applied to different cases, yeah.
Yeah, but to get your theorem roughly right, I would imagine that you would have to take different parameters then.
Yes, I'll come to that in a second. I'll show you how we actually phenomenologically fix the parameters. And you know, the parameter in the Fermi gas is called the Fermi momentum, but when we actually fit experiment, it isn't that simple. It's building in initial and final state interactions in some effective way that we don't really understand. We just do it as phenomenology. Okay, so let me now launch into a little bit of discussion of some of the scaling ideas. And the point here is that we have quite a bit of trouble putting together any relativistic model that can do everything. We basically have had to have a mixture of observation phenomenology blended with some theory behind it. And that's the issue of scaling. I wanted to give you at least a quick pass through this. It's obviously something that's used in many places, and you probably best know it for lepton-parton scaling, I mean Bjorkane scaling at very high energies with Bjorkane X, or variations thereof, other scaling variables. It's also, and in fact it's where it came from condensed matter physics, and so some of these things go way back in time. Where they came from. I'm going to focus on the middle one, which is the nuclear one, for obvious reasons. And so let me give you some idea of what we do. So we start off and say, let's imagine that we have this as our basic process. And now I'm going to do electron scattering, but you could read neutrino, muon here. It doesn't matter. It's all the same kind of problem. It's semi-leptonic. Exchanging something, and it's really the nuclear physics part here that I'm concerned about. So what we do is say that you have some A-body nucleus coming in. You detect, in this case, a nucleon, a proton or neutron, and then there's something unobserved. So the A-1 is not observed. So that will be semi-inclusive, that particular process. We have energy and momentum transfers indicated there in the yellow box. So a little bit of basic formalism, it's pretty trivial, but just to make sure we're all on the same page. Obviously, there's formal momentum conservation, so we can eliminate the missing formal momentum from the problem. It proves to be convenient, for reasons I'll come to right away, to use what's called the missing momentum. And I'm just calling it P, but it's the magnitude of the A minus one system. And I'm not saying what that is. That's not trivial. That can be the ground state. Say it's carbon 12 is your target. It can be the and a proton. Then it can be the ground state of boron 11. Or it can be the A minus two body system plus another neutron coming out. Or it can be whatever it is. It doesn't matter, however complicated it is. So this quantity is determined by measuring the nucleon's momentum compared to the momentum transfer. If it were semi-inclusive, you would know both three vectors, and so you can reconstruct this. And one has an excitation energy, as I put in quotes here. The experimentalists tend to like to use the missing energy. I've always found this script E variable a little more convenient because it's devised such that when it's zero, you've gone to the ground state of the daughter. Yeah?
When there's more than one proton, do you select on the fastest one?
It's said as an experimentalist would say it. That is, they have a detector, they saw one proton. So it's the integral over everything that happens. Okay. From the particle physics point of view, they think about all the particles that are produced and they keep trying harder and harder to detect all of them. In this case, it's really semi-inclusive, meaning one and only one integral over everything else. Okay. And partly because we focus on that, partly because there is some chance we can understand that. Whereas I think if you start saying, give me the cross-section for two protons and one neutron and together with a muon, forget it. That's just, we could make, many factors of 10 probably in the cross-section and get it wrong. So anyway, pushing on, this quantity is essentially the missing energy minus the separation energy. It's just offset basically by a well-known number you can look up in nuclear tables. Okay, after a little bit of work, you find this kind of thing is characteristic. So if you are at low excitation energy, which means here below this typical quasi-elastic condition, then the allowed region is as indicated. Okay, so that's just kinematics, nothing more nor less. You just work it through. But it means everything outside that region is forbidden, given that Q and omega are fixed. Okay, so a semi-inclusive process would put a point somewhere in this shaded area. Okay, the inclusive says do the integral over this whole thing. And I'm showing you this and spending a little bit of time on it because this is where the nuclear physics issue is met. Because now what you need to do is say, as a function of the missing energy and the missing momentum, tell me where the nuclear physics resides. Where do the things peak? And obviously, if you think about it, the kind of expectation would be when this is zero, you've gone to the ground state of the daughter nucleus. Again, example would be carbon 12, E prime P, let's say, and you go to the ground state of boron 11. That's largely speaking a P3 halves whole. Okay, so what you should expect is something along script E equals zero that starts at zero, peaks, and then falls off exponentially. In other words, sort of the momentum distribution of a P shell nucleon in this carbon 12 boron region. And if you're really naive and just do strict shell model, you'd expect another state that would be the 1s knockout. Now, of course, that's not what you see. These things have more nuclear physics going on than that. And then the problem starts to be that there are short range effects, as we know. The short range effects tend to push a lot of the strength up into a kind of region here. So you can think of a sort of topological map, and you've got a kind of ill-defined region running up through here where you have two particle emission. because a lot of the correlations in the initial state are such that fairly high momenta are involved. So the people who work very hard to try and model that try and put all of those effects in. In other words, what they try and do is provide a spectral function representation of all of the above, the shell model-like physics, the correlation-like physics. And so what you're doing when you do inclusive scattering is you've got some sort of map of nuclear physics, and you've got to do the integral so defined over that. Well, very typically, this stuff, the correlation stuff, amounts to maybe 20% or so of the total strength. And so at the 75-80%, most of it is all focused down on these shell model-like pieces. And so without knowing this, what people did, and this is way back to the late 60s, in fact, is they said, well, look, the nuclear physics is way down here and way down here. It's down in this little sector. And so why don't we just simply use this point as a special point in the problem? And I'll come back to that in a moment. It is conventionally defined to be minus y, and as you'll see in a moment, y is negative, so that this is a sensible thing to do. If you go above the quasi-elastic peak, it's a little more complicated, but it's the same kind of thing. Y is now positive, and the region is a little bit more complicated. It's easy to argue these things geometrically, why they look this way, but the same sort of problem. So, first of all, instead of Q and omega, Q squared and mu, Q squared and X pure K, whatever you want for inclusive scattering, there are two variables. And so instead of Q and omega, you can use Q and Y. That's just a change of variable. It does nothing. And you can assume that the inclusive cross-section is largely made up of the sums of the integrals over knocking protons out or neutrons out. That's not exactly right. There has to be a correction for double counting, but I won't worry about that for this purpose. So this is what I just said in words, that you expect most of the stuff to be here. You can't access here, and you expect it to be very small out here because these shell model things are all falling off with exponential fall off in this region. And so you're really led to do a couple of things. One is, and one does this and sort of cringes at doing it, but there's nothing else we can do. We take various versions of off-shell single nucleon cross-sections, but we evaluate them at that special point and take it out of the integral that's involved. So you get rid of the single nucleon. Say more about that if you want to hear more. And so you evaluate it by working at this special point. Okay?
What was y defined again?
Sorry?
How was y defined again?
Y is basically in magnitude, it is this lowest missing momentum that is accessible in the problem. Now, in a sense, if you go back and you try and argue Bjarkane scaling, it basically becomes an argument of longitudinal versus transverse. And at some level, it says throw away transverse. And so you're led naturally to a variable that's x. What this is doing is a little bit different, but it's got a lot of the same character to it. It's saying, look, we know something about the nuclear physics. We know where it peaks. So why don't we evaluate everything where it peaks and get that out of the integral? Okay. Now, it doesn't do you any harm. You can still do exactly what I said. You evaluate things at that special point, and you define this quantity. Now, it doesn't matter what it is. It's just perfectly well defined. I haven't lost anything. It just represents nature a different way. Okay? Instead of showing the inclusive cross-section, I can show this, and it, I haven't lost anything. People get all upset about this. They always feel that we're somehow putting a model in at this stage. And all I'm saying is we've been motivated to do this. Let's do it and see what happens. In effect, it's the same sort of thing always in electron scattering. You do elastic electron scattering from lead 208, let's say. You measure a single differential cross-section. But usually you don't present that. Usually you divide by the Mott cross-section and present a form factor. So what? I mean, as long as we all agree on the Mott cross-section, the information content has not gone away. This is the same spirit. This is still a function of these two variables. So here's an example. This is actually from fairly old data, but they range over the largest range available. These were from SLAC. This is actually helium-4. The energies go from modest, meaning a GeV or so, to this is actually 14 GeV. So this is only now in the range of Jefferson Lab. But at SLAC, they could do this in years past. So these are the inclusive cross-sections on helium. If the energy is low, you see the quasi-elastic peak here. You see the delta here. And you see it again and again, and then it just goes away. And so you assume that this is all deep and elastic scattering. And it very definitely is not. It's not that at all. It's not as simple as that. So you do it anyway. You give it a try. You say, this is an experiment. Divide by that thing I said and see what you get for the other function. So that, which is pretty chaotic, turns into that, which is not too bad. You know, this is a semi-log scale, and you know, a factor of 2 is, you know, it's not that good. But I actually invite you to go and look at Bjorkaean scaling. It's not that good either, really. It's always a kind of swindle the way it's presented. But if you actually try and compress it all, instead of having it offset as the standard PDG figure shows, if you put it all together, you find a factor of 2 spread there also. So you know, this is encouraging though, that things scale this well. So we call this Y-scaling initially, but for various reasons, we now are calling it scaling of the first kind because we have 4 types of scaling so far. Okay.
So is that actually just empirics, or is there some theoretical motivation?
Well, okay, so you do empiricism, which is this. Okay, you do it, you've got a motivation, you do it, you see if it works. Now you start fighting it with models to see, do the models work or don't they? And as you'll see in a few minutes, modeling in this region down here is really hard. You know, for example, let's take the best sort of mean field description that we have. Relativistic mean field. I mean, well, I'm only talking relativistic. Basically, you'll get an answer which is really good here at the peak, and then it just drops off the table. It's just absolutely nowhere close to those data. Then people start waxing poetic about short-range correlations, and they start doing things with those. And they manage to get some strength out here, but then we come along and we do meson exchange currents, and we get strength there too. So which is it? Is it both? Is it some mixture of the two? That's where we stand. We really don't know. You have to do the modeling and see if you can account for it. In any case, at least one should understand what nature is doing. A second thing, and this was, it's old at this stage, but it was much more recent than the first kind scaling, you realize that it might be wise, and the motivation here is the Fermi gas again, to have one parameter that you can dial. It's called the Fermi momentum, but it's really not. It's an effective parameter that captures more physics than just the standard ground state description using a Fermi gas. And so the answer you get for this one parameter is not what you would typically use were you to model the ground state of carbon-12 or lead-208 or something. But what you do is you say, why not get the density scale, if you like, out of the problem? And so instead of big F, you use little f by taking this momentum scale out. Big F has dimensions of 1 over momentum, so it makes it dimensionless. And then to keep the area conserved, you do the reverse for the x-axis. Where I plotted things versus y, you now make that dimensionless. Roughly speaking, but not exactly, by dividing by this momentum scale to make it dimensionless. And we usually call that psi, as I indicated here. And so you give that a try. So this is a little bit different. So what this is fixed kinematics. You can see the energy and scattering angle there, and four different nuclei, carbon-12, aluminum-27, iron-56, and gold-197, which were favored targets of a certain collaboration that did these studies. They're all nice targets experimentally. So it's now little f dimensionless, taking this momentum scale out versus this, which also has the scale taken out. But it's otherwise the same information, just plotted a little differently.
What is this momentum scale? Is it a root mean square momentum?
It's sort of, but you know, every attempt I've made to actually model it has failed. It's something that has to know about the ground state. It has to know about the mean binding energy in the nucleus, and it has something to do with final state interactions. And so it's some strange mean quantity. Yeah. I've been frustrated by that. I'd like to have a good model, even a sort of simplified model, to understand it. And so at present, we just treat it as a parameter. And it's been adjusted, so there are four parameters here, so that you line these things up. Okay, so you look at it and you say, well, so what? You didn't tell me anything. You know, you can make the curves line up if you have one parameter. And that was our reaction when we originally made this plot. It was kind of fun. This was back in the age where you had to put things on a plotter and go to the next room and get the print and come back and stare at it. And we looked and said, well, that's nice, and so on. And then I said, well, now wait a minute, maybe we should do this on a semi-log scale so we can see what's going on down here. Because I expected that these things would line up, and then in this maybe short-range correlation region, these curves would all peel off and start breaking down. That absolutely is not what you find. And I think that really astonished us when we got that plot. You can make these line up. We've now added helium-4 to the problem. You can make the response from helium-4 to gold-197 line up over this whole region at the 5% level. I mean, that's really remarkable. If you think of all the ways this might not happen, it's not what I expected, that's for sure.
How different is the momentum scale for the different nuclei?
That's part of the issue. So it basically goes from, it's about 200 for helium-4 to about 240 or so for gold. And then if you start even going lighter, helium-3 and the triton would be maybe 150. And what's totally anomalous is the deuteron. It's about 55. It's much, much smaller. I have another comment to make if I ever get to all these comments a little bit later in this talk. Anyway, yeah, go ahead.
What exactly is cyclon, the definition of cyclon?
So it's basically y divided by this momentum scale, just to make it dimensionless. Y had dimensions, MeV over C, if you like, and so this makes it dimensionless. And basically, we're motivated to multiply here, and so you're motivated to divide here, and then it's sort of the conjugate for the x and y axes. You could plot it versus whatever y if you want, but this had a motivation, and again, it's phenomenology. We just simply do it and see if it works. So this we called scaling of the second kind. This kind of thing is actually quite valuable, however, because now if your models obey this kind of scaling, then at least for stuff in this region, you've got a chance that you can model one nucleus and just scale and have the answer for a different one. Okay? And so one of the programs some of us have in mind is to study light nuclei, meaning carbon and below, where you can do the heavy lifting, which a lot of you folks do, a really much more sophisticated treatment of the many-body problem. But where you run out of the ability to do that as completely when you get to argon, let's say, which is what the experimentalists want. But if your model over the range of light nuclei scales like this and verifies this, you've got a good chance that you can just scale your answer up to argon. And so this is not a trivial statement. You have to prove it. using theory as against what is now observation. Yeah, Susan.
I just was wondering, I mean, this is very interesting to see the nuclear independence in this manner, but is it manifest as we vary epsilon and theta? I mean, it could, nothing, there's no, this is...
Oh, yes, oh, yes.
Success of...
Oh, no, no, no.
You don't understand.
No, no, we look at many different energies and scattering.
So, so there, it always seems to work?
It does, oh, yeah, yeah. Every time we look at this, barring very low values, then this doesn't work well at all. For very low energies, if you like, low momentum transfer, then it begins to break down. But if the scale is this kind of GV scale, everything we've looked at works beautifully. Now, it doesn't work up here for reasons that should be well understood, because this is now where inelasticity is cutting in. There are other processes. You're producing pions. The delta is playing a role. And the scaling shouldn't work for those. Those are different processes. So I'm really talking about zero and down in this negative region that is the nuclear physics. But of course, we've looked at the whole set of data taken to understand this. Yeah?
Did you find a correlation between this momentum scale that you introduced and the nuclear size as you go from helium to...
Not really, gold? Not really. One of the papers, we have a little table that gives the values we got. And in a sense, the question you had earlier of fixing the parameters, our claim would be that whatever the meaning of this parameter in this kind of model, relativistic Fermi gas model, which is not what this is, but if you were to use that, this is the way you fix that parameter. And if you vary the Fermi momentum, you know, carbon is 225 MeV over C. If you change it to 230, you get dramatic deviations from this coalescence. It's very sensitive to getting that empirical parameter fixed, and that's how we fix it. Yeah?
So if this GV energy range, what exactly is a typical event? How many nuclei are coming out? How much do you break the whole thing apart?
That's the burning question, is to actually understand. Experimentally, it's basically not understood. The measurements have not been done. They're very hard. And in electron scattering, it's typically done with spectrometers, and they have very small acceptances in momentum, in solid angle. And so if you detect a proton, you fix the kinematics. It takes a long time to do the experiment, and so you say, okay, I've done something, and move on to the next thing. There's been no systematic study of this landscape, which I think is regrettable. Using a detector as the class detector at Jefferson Lab, that's more, you know, it's a large acceptance detector that measures many things, but the luminosity is excruciatingly low in that device. And so you see the tops of the peaks. You could never, never go out here and study that with a class-type detector. So it's really a frustration. And see, neutrinos are somewhat different, because you have these gigantic tanks of something, you know, hydrocarbon of some kind. And so volumetrically, you see all the tracks that are, whatever's going on. And now with these TPCs, that's exactly what they want to do and are doing already. So you see the muon in one detector, and you see protons, and sometimes you see two protons. And they don't see neutrons, so they don't know about the neutrons, and maybe there are three protons. So one is getting information. But to ask us to model it is partly where I get upset. It's a very, very difficult problem. I'm this talk is obviously too long. Anyway, scaling of the second kind. This is a very special case. What this is for a small subset of the world data, it's been possible to make a Rosenbluth separation. That is to separate the longitudinal and transverse electron scattering responses. Unfortunately, it's a small subset. It'd be nice to have a much wider range of measurements. The longitudinal is very special, because if you do any modeling that makes any sense at all, you find, first of all, pion production is just negligible. It's dominated by the delta, which is transverse. If you do anything sensible with meson exchange currents, it's negligible. It's basically the way Seeger's theorem works. The leading behavior of MEC is purely transverse, and that's only in higher order that you begin to see effects that are in the longitudinal sector. So this is a pure nuclear physics study at fairly high energies, not as high as we'd like, but fairly high. But now what I've done is I've put three nuclei and three values of Q on the same plot. And so first kind and second kind scaling are both coming into play. And so we had a toss out sentence in a paper a long time ago, which without, let's invent a name for this. So if both work, we call it superscaling. And it works. Okay. This is very important, though, for a different reason. Under these conditions, you notice, first of all, where the peak is. It's about correct. And you notice that it's definitely asymmetric. There is definitely strength over here that is very significantly not over here. So, for example, when neutrino people show you a plot of a cross-section versus a neutrino energy, they have always said that the peak is here and all the physics is symmetrical around it. And so when you see E sub neutrino, sometimes they call it E quasi-elastic neutrino, they're both wrong. They're just derived parameters. If you said, what is the mean or highest expectation value for the neutrino energy in a given experiment, obviously it's going to be over here someplace. The weighting is not the way they've invoked it. That means you don't know the energy. That means you don't know L over E. That means the study of oscillations is flawed. How flawed is the real problem? I mean, that's partly what we're after here. Okay, I think I'm going to have to start moving faster here, just show you a few things. This is now actually comparing some better modeling against the Fermi gas. So first of all, that's called fit. That was a phenomenological fit to these results of three nuclei, three values of momentum transfer. Relativistic mean field theory, we just simply use standard solutions of the Dirac equation with scalar and vector potentials whose strengths and ranges are set to fit phenomenology of elastic scattering, of separation energies, this kind of thing. So it's not that sophisticated, but it is relativistic mean field theory. We just do it, and the answer is, as you can see, essentially the experimental answer. If you do what some people would like to do and do the relativistic plane wave impulse approximation, where you treat the final state with plane waves, but you use Dirac-Hartree for the initial states, you get this curve, which is definitely not working very well, and it's also missing strength out here. And the Fermi gas is even worse. So a lot of the analyses that have been done up to date have actually basically been using this, whereas they should be using this, is what it amounts to. And some modeling is actually verifying that this is pretty good. Again, without going into details with the relativistic mean field theory, the second kind scaling, the scaling from nucleus to nucleus, is superb. It's just very, very good in that model. We've tried a variety of other models, relativized, non-relativistic modeling. Other groups have done similar things using our ideas. The second kind scaling almost always works beautifully. So this ability to go from one nucleus to another, it looks as though it's possible. Okay, a few comments on the meson exchange currents. So these are the standard pion exchange MEC that we include. We use a variety of different Lagrangians for this, but basically it's the typical thing where we've absorbed Z graphs into a contact term. So it started years ago with the Peccei-Lagrangian. We can use more modern ones. It doesn't make an awful lot of difference, in fact. But we do include the delta, as indicated, and it actually provides the biggest contribution in this high energy region that we're dealing with. There are lots of problems, issues. When you've got the delta here, what do you do about its width? What do you do about the real and imaginary parts of it? I mean, there are all kinds of issues that are done a little bit differently by different people. Okay, so what do we actually do? Well, we started this actually in the 1970s, non-relativistically, and I'll show some results that are more modern. We managed some years ago to do it fully relativistically, meaning that we use, again, the relativistic Fermi gas, but now we do two-particle, two-hole, and we do it with these as the current in the problem. So when we started this, it seemed like a good idea. I mean, the Fermi gas is all on shell. It has energy-conserving delta functions floating around, conserving the flow momentum at the different vertices. You get rid of the three momenta immediately, but it's got some energy-conserving factors that you can integrate immediately. It's got the spinners for the particles involved, the currents themselves, and it's got a bunch of theta functions because it's the Fermi gas. The Fermi gas is a degenerate zero-temperature Fermi gas, completely filled below the Fermi surface, completely empty above. Theta functions, delta functions, on-shell things. It sounded as though one should be able to go through this and get the answer. Well, unfortunately, even if you integrate the delta functions, you're left with seven-dimensional integrals. So you have to Monte Carlo the seven-dimensional integrals. And then when you put all this stuff in, and you put all the spinners in, and you set it up in the form of traces, you get a fair number of terms. By a fair number of terms, what I mean is somewhere on the order of 110 to 120,000 terms. It seemed like a much simpler problem than that. So we eventually, sort of 10, 15 years ago, did actually do all 120,000 traces and put all these seven-dimensional integrals in and get an answer. It's much easier today. Computation, even in this decade and a half, has changed enough to make it doable. But it is not a trivial problem. And if you were to try and do better modeling of the initial state other than the Fermi gas that we're tacking on, this would just escalate tremendously. So unfortunately, there are only about three groups anywhere that have managed to get up to speed on this problem. It's not that simple. And of the three groups, we claim we're the only ones that have really done the whole problem. People have made approximations in the course for the other groups. There are some subtle direct and exchange aspects. Very recently, instead of doing traces, another component of our collaboration decided to take on the problem where you just put the spinners in with spin, helicity if you like, and isospin, and just sum over all those indices. You know, just work out the matrix with the spinners and gamma matrices and so on. It took us a while, but the answers exactly agree. So done one way or the other, we're pretty confident we finally know what the answer is. So this is an example. This one is of this earlier work, so it's now more than 10 years old. It's the same kind of thing I was showing of this scaled quantity versus a scaling variable, so that the standard one-body process, the quasi-elastic one-body process, would scale in this case. And while it's kind of a bizarre curve, this thing with dots here is actually the Fermi gas. Now, if you look at other types of models, and I'd said this a little earlier, relativistic mean field theory does better here, and it comes down and it sort of dies around here. It doesn't have the content. And when you think of it, it's kind of interesting that it does so badly, because it's the same theory, after all, that is an alternative for saturation of nuclear matter. Okay, you don't need to have short-range violent potentials, as is the traditional way of doing it. If you do the Walechka-type thing, you also stabilize nuclear matter with relativistic mean field theory for translationally invariant systems. And yet it doesn't have the right content. It's just clear. It's just not getting this stuff at all. On the other hand, and it's, I wouldn't be too worried that the theory is above experiment here. These, that you could dial lots of things to change this. But the meson exchange currents are comparable to the data out here. So a lot of these results that were initially attributed to short-range correlations may actually not be that. They may be due to the two-body operators in the problem.
When you say meson exchange currents, does that include the fact that pion can actually be produced?
No.
On-shell?
No. So we,
then you would have
that's right.
Production that, and
right.
absorption, and you would go to the
that's
same
right.
final state.
In a certain peculiar way, if you really tried to compute everything, you would just simply put in the Feynman diagrams I showed and compute. But for various reasons having to do with the distinction of the types of scaling, we put them in two separate boxes. And so where the pion propagator is involved, we take only its real part. We don't let it go on shell.
But wouldn't you expect a lot of
action? Oh, yes. Oh, sure.
Pion production and reabsorption?
Absolutely. But, and that is up here.
Yeah.
That's up here. Pion production threshold for whatever kinematics is being shown. I mean, a whole set are being shown. But a typical curve here, there is some point below which you can't produce pions.
Well, also pion rescattering and then not reabsorption, right?
Yeah.
Well, free nuclei.
Yeah. And see, that's actually exactly the kind of thing that I would say. The modeling should be more sophisticated if we could find a way to do it. At present, this is the Fermi gas, initial and final state. It's the most naive thing you can do, and it's still a challenge to do it. But one should really have interacting initial state, interacting final state with rescattering, with all of this. Absolutely, I agree. I totally agree. Yeah.
How should one actually interpret the diagrams they showed in the last slide? So it looks suspiciously like some sort of chiral expansion, but then you hit it with multi-GeV energy.
Well, you know, the sorts of things we look at, and this is the kind of thought I had when I listened to many of the talks you folks were giving. You know, if we take one of these contributions, say this, and we look at that propagator and that propagator, and we make approximations, such as a static approximation. In other words, we go towards trying to capture the physics in simple vertices, let's say, which is a kind of crude way of saying what one does at low energies with a lot of the physics. It's all over the place. It turns out the dynamical nature of those propagators is essential. So if this, for instance, take the delta, if we make the static approximation, we get a very different answer from making it dynamic. And so it's very different from what you're saying. I think the ideas many of you have been expounding on are just really, you just can't do them at these scales. We're driving multi-GeV through the delta.
Sure, that's why I was asking, what is the theory behind these ideas?
It's just a standard field theory of baryons and mesons with certain vertices, a certain Lagrangian, and the propagators that come from Klein-Gordon, Dirac, and Rarotonen-Schwinger equations.
You wouldn't know how to calculate loop corrections to this.
No. I mean, I could argue a lot what you might be asking, and that is, see, we're doing perturbation theory. We're doing what amounts to leading order perturbation theory with 1 pi exchange type diagrams. And so you could just say, well, come on, that's all the things you folks do at low energies, you'd never get away with that. This is so different, this problem, where the particle hole states you're producing have the particle at 500 MeV and the hole at minus 20 or something. This is so dramatically different from what you do if you do the ground state. And the way I've tried to argue, maybe this will help you, but if you took a very naive sort of shell model approach, you would say typical lightish nuclei or SPD type orbitals that are involved, however they're involved, however sophisticated. And so they're peaking and falling off. And if you now go to the final state at 500 MeV, the most probable partial wave is an L equals 50 wave. Okay, and if it's an L equal 50 wave and you've got an angular momentum barrier, you know what the wave function looks like. 0, 0, 0, 0, and then it starts to oscillate. So you've got a fantastic mismatch of the starting point and the final. And you've only got the photon in this case to mediate between the two. And if you start sticking these in, what you want is the longest range thing you've got, which is pi on exchange. You know, for example, we have looked at higher, other diagrams involving other mesons, and they tend to be very, very small under these conditions. And we try to work to 2 pi exchange, and they tend to also be very, very small. So it's a crazy problem. This is where perturbation theory with pions actually works. It's completely in conflict with everything you folks are saying for low energy, where, of course, you can't get away with that at all.
So I guess you have the form factors of the vertices.
There are some buried, stuff buried under the, there are issues, yes. There are vertex functions, there are issues of gauge invariance, there are ways of, you know, specifying that you better do this or you're going to break gauge invariance, all kinds of problems, and some of them very old. It's an effective theory. It's you know, but it's a very simple effective.
You don't think about regions or
No. There are an endless number of things that could be tried, and so I'm only trying to say what we've done to this point. Yeah.
Can you rule out that the dominant process is just single photon knockout? Is that something you considered?
Yes, in the sense that we need these effects to get agreement with experiment. Ultimately, whatever our model, we've got to go back to experiment. And I'll show you that almost immediately.
Yeah, I'm not connecting with these diagrams. I'm actually connecting with whether or not the dominant experimental result is that you have an intact A minus one nucleus.
It's
maybe in an excited state.
Yeah, I mean, very typically we don't. We have all types of states, the bound states of A minus one, the A minus two plus another particle, A minus three plus two more particles, all of that is being fed into this. Now, our argument, and it has been up to this point, is this is inclusive scattering. Inclusive scattering is a total hadronic cross-section. And so, you know, as long as...
Are you always working on quasi-elastic kinematics?
No. Oh, no, 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 no. Yeah.
Would have a simple validity from the standing of Y effects of higher mesons are small?
Partly this hand-waving argument I gave you in coordinate space. It's very shaky, but it at least motivates why the mismatch is so dramatic between what you have to have in the initial state and have to have in the final state. I think it partly motivates it. Look, the argument is actually in other places, and I'm always amazed at, I'll just throw it out, why it's not made more forcefully. But for instance, neutrinoless double beta decay has the same issue, because by the way it works, the initial types of configurations and the final have a big mismatch. And so when you do it, there's a big momentum change. The effect of momentum transfer in that process is 200 to 300 to 400 MeV over C. It is so dramatically different from 2 neutrino double beta decay, and somehow this hasn't really dawned on people that this mismatch of the configurations involved drives the problem in a certain direction in different processes. 10. Okay, a little faster. It's good. I mean, I'm happy that we got lots of questions. I'm going to skip through this pretty quickly, but I do want to show you the sort of state of the art of the problem. This is what we call the superscaling approach, the SUSE approach, and this set of people working on this is called the SUSE collaboration. So we now start by saying, look, we did pretty well with this universal scaling function, so let's start there. And then let's unplug the elastic cross-section, elastic on a nucleon, and plug in the inelastic instead, but use the same nuclear physics. That's what step 2 is. We add the MEC well, okay, this is sort of a hybrid. We're adding something that is not being treated on the same footing. But because we already know the scaling properties of the MEC are not the same as they are for the first part, the quasi-elastic dominated part, we really should treat these somewhat separately. Now, that's not very comfortable because it would be much more satisfying to have a consistent, unified theory. At low energies, one does. So ab initio calculations in, say, carbon 12 are consistent, but they're non-relativistic. And so they can't address this energy range. We compare with electron scattering. We unplug the electron scattering, plug in the neutrino, and see what happens. That's in a nutshell what we're doing.
But the ab initio calculations are given a good representation of the initial state. You can take and then make it relative to the extent.
This is what some people are hoping to do. It's still, there are lots of issues with it. Okay, so the imaginary time approach to circumvent the inability to use closure, I mean, I'm saying this quickly, but effectively taking the delta function, energy conserving, Fourier transforming, you have an EVI omega t, you go to imaginary time. I'm sure you're familiar with this sort of approach, runs into some trouble because the relativistic currents depend on omega. Non-relativistically, they don't. There are boost effects, and they're not taken into account. And it's not easy to take them into account. So I better press on. Anyway, if you don't get the electron scattering right, forget it for neutrinos. So we have an updated version of this. If anyone is interested, we can talk offline. I wanted, however, to show you the state of the art. So this has the three ingredients. The three ingredients are our scaling model for what's called quasi-elastic, the MEC model that I just talked about or summarized, and it has the inelastic, as I said, where you use the same nuclear physics, the scaling, but you put in the inelastic cross-section. So I'm not making a model. I'm not saying N to delta, this resonance, that resonance, non-resonant pi production, deep inelastic scattering. It is taken from experiment. You measure this on the proton, and you put it in with the same nuclear physics. So I'm sorry, these are kind of small figures. But the basic point is you see data, which are the dark things, specks all over it. And you see a purple curve, which in most cases goes through the data. Now they're a little, you know, some of them are not quite as good. But
well, it's a separate curve.
Yeah. Not fit to the data, though.
But they are separate curves. What is the difference? There
are slight variations. I can't even read the caption. We've done slight variations on a theme, but basically, and what I want to emphasize, though, is this is not a fit to data. This is a fit initially to those scaled results, which are data. And having fixed the parameters, we just let it go and see what happens. And that's what happens. So this is a very low momentum transfer. This is getting a little higher. Still higher. So this is even below the range for Fermilab. These are still pretty low values, but you begin to see, you know, ones where here's the delta, here's the quasi-elastic. That's doing very well. Let me just finish and then come to it. Okay. But we keep on going. We look at the world data. This is all carbon, I should have said. So here's the remainder. So you go from 600 MeV over C to 3.4 GV over C. And so this last curve, that is not a fit. It's just what drops out of this, the scaling analysis. Or come down, you know, you're doing beautifully here, beautifully here. So this is really actually the state of the art. And our challenge to competing groups has been, show us what you got, basically. You've got to, you know, go to the electron scattering and show you can do just as well. And absolutely, I can tell you, most of them don't. There are there's been a lot of cherry picking in this business where people do something and then they pick the right example to show how wonderful it is without being systematic. Can I answer your question?
My question is, all of these plots seem to have one line sort of in like gray or lilac-ish that doesn't resemble the data at all.
This is the momentum transfer as you go across the plot.
Great.
It's because the more you look at these, you know, the more you say, tell me what the momentum transfer. I should ask the collaborator to give me a new figure with those removed. Okay. Here are a few quick results for charge-changing neutrinos. Just, you know, now the procedure is clear. You just change the electromagnetic pieces over to charge-changing weak pieces. You've got issues such as, do you really know what the axial form factor looks like at high Q squared? You do things that are popular, that is, you put in a dipole and you change the mass. You've all heard about this. By and large, you don't have to do that, it turns out. So things are reasonably good. I mean, sometimes very good. Neutrino, antineutrino, pretty good. Even a case like this, this is NOMAD, the red points, and look at the scale. This is going up to 100 GeV. Again, remember, this is in quotation marks. The energy is not a measured, known quantity. And so you look at our modeling, and certainly does just perfectly well. And so you ask, how can you possibly be representing that physics with what I've just told you about, right?
But in your model, the 1 GeV is really 1 GeV, or you?
We try to do what they do.
Okay.
So this should be called, you know, capital T or something, mm-hmm. just some symbol that doesn't make you think it's the neutrino energy. It's a derived quantity. And whatever they do, we do the same thing. So I'll try and finish now if I can. Pretty good. And you say, but wait a minute, you put in quasi-elastic, meson exchange currents, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but surely these are dramatically high energy conditions where this modeling should be nonsense. And I'm saying this to you to warn you. In this case, one is showing a total cross-section. And it so happens that if you actually go in and look at what gives rise to these events, they're actually occurring at relatively low momentum transfer. They are 10 to 100 GeV neutrinos with muons going out in milliradians from the direction of the neutrino, exchanging very little momentum and energy to the nucleus. And so to say automatically when this variable is running over this kind of energy range, you must be doing ultra-high energy partonic physics is just absolutely not correct. It's also strictly nuclear physics. Okay, let me just slip through these antineutrinos, some more stuff. Semi-inclusive, I won't talk about. I will talk about this just in passing, because as soon as you do semi-inclusive, instead of electron scattering, RL, RT, there are two responses, function of two variables. If you do semi-inclusive, there are 16 response functions, and they're all functions of four variables. And it is going to be daunting to interpret any experiment in terms of this stuff. And they don't all go away. It's not as though some of them are 1% corrections, as we already know. So the symmetric and anti-symmetric contractions look like this with all these different response functions. It's like the Rosenbluth formula, except it's now generalized to this higher order. Coherent, this is what I knew I wouldn't get to, but show you the bottom line, which is this, which is a very cute formula. Just in passing, I'll at least expose you to this. Elastic, coherent neutrino scattering from some ground state is equal to coherent elastic electron scattering, parity conserving, ordinary electron scattering, times the parity violating asymmetry on that system squared, with no other factors. And so if the experimentalists can measure This side, which they are hoping to measure to parts in a thousand, those asymmetries are parts in a million. So they are talking about uncertainties of parts in a billion on asymmetries in the not too distant future. You can measure this to maybe a percent and interpret it. This is hard. It's probably tough to get past 3% or so, but one can make a test of beyond the standard model at the few percent level by seeing if this formula is obeyed or not. Because the hadronic physics is identical. It's a Z connecting with the nuclear ground state, both cases. Okay, I'll just flash the summary here and stop. Thank you.